From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. On today's show, Young Jean Lee is the first Asian-American woman to have a play on Broadway. Her play, Straight White Men, examines privilege in a new light. Then, 50 years into his career, Boss Skaggs has a spry new album based on the soul and R&B that inspired him.
Most of us that make records get so close to the material that you feel it's just really marvelous. And you think, well, the world's going to love this. And it doesn't always go that way.
And composer Max Richter invites you to sleep during his concert. All that coming up on The Frame. It's rare these days for a drama to play Broadway, much less one with a provocative title like Straight White Men. But the show by Korean-American playwright Young Jean Lee has just opened, and the New York Times review says it's undeniably powerful, an exceedingly odd, and thus welcome presence on Broadway. Young Jean Lee was born in South Korea and came to the U.S. as a toddler with her immigrant parents. Writing a play called Straight White Men is in keeping with one description of her as the most adventurous playwright of New York's off-Broadway experimental theater scene. But Straight White Men is Lee's most straightforward play. It's focused on a single father and his three adult sons who are home for Christmas. One of them is an underachiever still living at home. The play challenges audiences to think about the privilege of being someone who matches the show's title. With the show now on Broadway, let's revisit John Horn's interview with Lee from 2015, when the play was produced at the Kirk Douglas Theater in Culver City. And here she explains the genesis of Straight White Men.
It came about because I was noticing that there was this shift that was happening where, you know, for so many years, straight white men didn't really have to contend with that label. In the way that they have to today. You know, for a long time, straight white men got to be the default human, and then everybody else had the label. And now straight white men are getting slapped with that label, which is why the title is what it is, because it's sort of about this moment where all of a sudden straight white men are starting to experience what everybody else has experienced forever. And they really, of course, like, hate the experience because, you know, nobody likes having a label slapped on them and told who they are because of that label.
The play is about straight white men, but it's also about a family. You have three siblings and a single parent. Do the relationships between the siblings and the parent lay bare some of the very ideas that you're trying to expose?
Well, you know, dramatically, it was necessary for it to be a family just because in the sort of world of straight white men that I discovered in my research, only in that context would men be likely to get in each other's business the way these men do. And even, you know, even though they're such a close family, like, it takes so long in the play for them actually to get to the point where they're confronting things, you know. But so, you know, for me, that family aspect was necessary just in order to get the men to start, you know, interfering in each other's lives.
Well, interfering and judging. I mean, I think that's part of the whole story, right? That the two younger siblings feel that the oldest brother is in some ways not taking advantage of the opportunities that he has in front of him.
Yes.
I mean, I guess that's the bigger question in terms of the opportunities that straight white men have and whether or not that's an opportunity or a burden, as the play is trying to explore.
Right. I mean, you know, I think it's absolutely, you know, it's, yes, it's an opportunity, it's a privilege, but, you know, things are changing. You know, I don't feel like, you know, there's a lot of straight white male paranoia that I've been researching as well, where they're like, oh my gosh, like, all of our power is eroded and now we're in the weaker position. And I don't buy that at all. But I do buy that that's sort of beginning, like, you know, the first rumblings of that are about to happen. And I do see a panic starting to sort of unfold, like, not in a widespread way, but there are men out there, straight white men out there, who are very self-abnegating as a response to their own privilege. And I feel like that's a pretty interesting and current thing.
There was a profile about you written in The New Yorker in which Hilton Ahl said you, and I'm quoting him now, wanted to create art about something that she did not entirely understand in a genre that she hadn't fully explored. I guess the genre would be something that's non-experimental, that's generally very straightforward, narrative, traditional playwriting.
Yes.
So why was the genre itself important to you?
I always like for the genre to be interacting with the subject matter. You know, I change genres a lot, and I always like it to be able to play with the form and the content in relation to each other. And I thought that if I'm going to write a play about straight white male identity, then it would be interesting to use the straight white male of theatrical genres, which is the naturalistic three-act play. And I sort of secretly sat in on an audience discussion, and they were so distressed. It was as if they had just seen Eraserhead or something. You know, they were just completely upset by the fact that there was no big revelation at the end. You know, nobody got shot, nobody killed themselves. You know, because if somebody gets shot or kills themselves, you know what happened to that person.
That the audience has been conditioned to think that a secret will be revealed. This is like, you know, Chekhov says, if you introduce a gun in the first act, you better shoot it by the end of the play. That they are waiting for the revelation.
Right.
And your point is, life doesn't unfold that way.
Especially not with this particular topic. I mean, I didn't do it. I mean, they were like, the playwright must be sadistic, but
They said in your presence.
Yeah, yeah. They said, but I didn't withhold a resolution that I had just to, you know, make people unhappy. I couldn't find a resolution.
And does that come back to this other idea that you wanted to explore something and you didn't entirely understand? And did you end up not totally understanding it at the end, or did you not want it to be fully understandable?
I mean, it wasn't about understanding or not understanding. I felt like I understood the problem. I just didn't understand the answer, you know, and I really tried hard to come up with something. But, you know, the answer to the question of, you know, how do you live an ethical life, you know, when you're somebody who has privilege, and it's very, very complicated, and I couldn't figure it out.
Do you feel at this point that you have a little bit of privilege as a playwright, and can you use that privilege to your advantage?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I feel like not even as a playwright. I mean, I feel like as an Asian female. I mean, one of the things that was so interesting to me when working on this play was I just realized, like, as a straight Asian female, how many privileges I share with straight white men. I can just say I'm an Asian female playwright just by sort of doing whatever I want and pursuing my ambition and getting ahead. I can say, oh, I'm increasing diversity in the world. You know, I'm doing something so great and heroic. But a straight white male wouldn't be able to say, like, oh, I'm making the world a better place just by virtue of my own success.
That was John Horn with playwright Young Jean Lee back in 2015. Her play Straight White Men just opened on Broadway. Coming up, when it comes to R&B, singer and guitarist Boss Skaggs definitely leans toward the blues side. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in this week for John Horn. There was a time in the mid to late 1970s where the blue-eyed soul rock sound of Boss Skaggs was inescapable. Songs like Lido Shuffle and Lowdown from the 1976 smash album Silk Degrees seamlessly fuse smooth R&B, rock and roll, and even disco. But after that initial flush of top 40 success, Skaggs' career waned a bit. He released just a handful of albums in the 80s and 90s, but the past 10 years have been among the most prolific for the 74-year-old Bay Area-based musician, releasing a string of acclaimed albums fueled by the blues and R&B that inspired him to pick up a guitar in the first place. His latest album, Out of the Blues, continues on that path, while also showcasing a few original songs and a surprising cover of Neil Young's On the Beach.
I went to the radio interview. I ended up all alone at the microphone.
Why did you choose that song to put alongside a collection of what is mostly R&B and blues tunes?
We were looking for material on this record that sort of showed off how the blues could evolve. And that song is very much a blues song in my way of thinking. But it's also a lament. It's pure poetry.
Yeah.
It's just another form to me, so it qualifies.
It's got that great lyric, I went to the radio interview, I ended up at the microphone all alone, and so I guess we're kind of living the lyrics today.
Living the life. Yeah. I turn those lyrics over often. They just keep coming at me.
Yeah. Well, Neil Young, like you, is a longtime Bay Area resident. San Francisco and later Napa had been home to you for decades, since the 1960s. You actually, as you said, you actually grew up in Oklahoma and Texas. What drew you to San Francisco back in the 1960s?
I came to play music. I'd been living in Europe and traveling for about 3 years, and I was sort of based in Sweden, in Stockholm at the time. And everyone was aware of what was going on in San Francisco with the Summer of Love and before and after. And I had a good friend in Stockholm who's was the brother of Jorma Kalkinen from the Jefferson Airplane.
Right.
He was coming back and forth between San Francisco. And so he would bring the latest stuff, posters and music. And so I was fascinated by what was going on there. And I had an invitation to come fill in as a sideman in a band in San Francisco. And so I came in September of 67, which was the end of the Summer of Love. And it was all happening. It was a big rodeo carnival cowboy show going on that was kind of wild.
Well, fast forward to 1976, and you release arguably the biggest record of your career, Silk Degrees. Let's hear a little bit of one of the many hits off that record from Silk Degrees, and then I can ask you about it.
Can't see the people, just stop and stare. Don't it make you wonder why? I just happen to be standing there. Can't you see?
That, of course, is Boz Scaggs from his 1976 album, Silk Degrees. So all these years later, what do you think of that recording and how that album came out?
It was very good fortune, that record.
Yeah.
It was my fifth or sixth or seventh album, I think. And there's a lot of miles and a lot of roads and a lot of gigs and a lot of things happened before that record came out and hit. Listening to it now, I think the arrangement stands up. It sounds like another voice to me. It certainly is from another time, but the arrangement sounds great.
It does. Did you feel at the time like you really had something special with those songs and that record?
I did, but I'd had that feeling before.
I
think most of us that make records get so close to the material and you become so engrossed in it that you feel it's just really marvelous and it's really what you, it sounds just great to you. And you think, well, the world's going to love this. And it doesn't always go that way.
Yeah.
It has a life of its own. So by the time that record came around, it was very special to me because of the musicians I worked with. I felt like I'd been looking for them for my whole life. But I really didn't allow myself to think that it was going to be anything more than the next record out. And it was just that, but it was a lot more.
Well, not long after your career really started to skyrocket, you also became something of a San Francisco music impresario, as part owner of two of San Francisco's most beloved music venues, Slim's and the Great American Music Hall. Why did you want to get involved in that side of the music business?
I had no idea. I'll tell you why. I was out with a buddy one night in San Francisco, and we went to three different music venues. We just had this idea. Let's find an old warehouse, a place that had cheap rent that we could get some good music in. And that came out of a situation that Bill Graham had a club, about a 600-seat club called Wolfgang's in San Francisco up in North Beach. And it had burned down within several months before. And it left a real void in San Francisco. There wasn't a club of that size that was running regularly. There were some venues about that size. So it opened, and 30 years later, it's still there.
Given, you know, how the music industry has changed in those years since you've been a club owner with digital downloading and so forth, do you find that performers, you know, have kind of more stock in performing live now and value it much more? And how has that changed the dynamic between, you know, club promoter, so to speak, and performer, if at all?
They still roll up in vans and buses of all shapes and sizes. And of course, the music industry as an industry and as a business has changed beyond recognition. But that live thing, and particularly in cities like San Francisco that has a live music tradition, is alive and well. And this is what feeds the clubs that are, we're the little fish. We start them off there and they grow.
There's this song I very much wanted to ask you about from the 2013 album, Memphis. It's a ballad called Sunny Gone, and it comes at the end of the album, and it's quite unlike the rest of the record. It's just you with the sparest of arrangements, and your voice is right out front.
Crazy to remember that frozen winter.
Can you tell me how that song came together and why you wanted to record it the way you did?
I played it for Steve Jordan, my producer on the record and co-musician. And he wanted to do it, and I had to write the lyrics of it. I'd had some scat lyrics for it, but as I got deeper and deeper into it, it turned out to be about a relationship. My first true love was in Stockholm, and it's about a love that I had and lost.
It wasn't meant to last forever, the sunny gone that way.
Well, let's close out with something from the new record, Out of the Blues, and I'd like to put you in the DJ chair and choose something and say a little something about it.
Okay. I'm going to choose a song that I co-wrote with a friend of mine, San Francisco guy, who actually wrote about five of the other songs on this record. His name is Jack Walworth. He's a harp player out of Chicago, but has been moved to San Francisco about the same time I did in the late 60s, and who's been a friend of mine for a long time. The song's called Little Miss Night and Day, and it comes from a demo that I did. I don't know when or where, but I sift through the old tapes from time to time when I'm beginning a project. And this little kind of a Texas Oklahoma shuffle came up, and I just liked the way it felt.
Oh, well, I found me a girl, it's a wonderful thing. I'm a wearing this smile, she's wearing my ring, she's like a talisman.
I'd done some scat lyrics on it, and as I listened back to the lyrics, there was a line in there that said, da 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 da, I call her Little Miss Night and Day, and it means absolutely nothing, it just phonetically happened to fit.
Maybe even not, but there's some kind of things a man can't find. Long story short, I'm all swept away. I ask her, what's your name? She said, call me Miss Nightingale.
It might realistically be a 3.5 or 4 minute song because it's just a shuffle groove. But this band just played the almighty hell out of this groove, and it's one of the most satisfying songs that I've ever recorded. And rather than edit it or shorten it down, I wanted every note that they played throughout, and I had to write 9 verses to a song that I had no idea what it was about.
That's Boss Gags. His new album is Out of the Blues. It's out this week. And he'll also be on tour this summer, including a performance at LA's Orpheum Theater in September. Boss Gags, thank you so much.
Thanks, Stephen. Great talking to you.
Up next on The Frame, why is composer Max Richter hosting a big sleepover this weekend in LA's Grand Park? Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas sitting in for John Horn. Most musicians would probably be a little irritated if you started snoozing during their concert. Not Max Richter. You've heard his music in the TV series The Leftovers and Taboo. Then there's his most famous piece, On the Nature of Daylight, used in everything from Shutter Island to Arrival. He's also composed a lot of contemporary classical music. And this weekend in Grand Park, people are invited to come here and perform one of his most recent works and to sleep. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving has the story.
Are you getting sleepy? That's the idea, according to the British composer who wrote this music, Max Richter.
I sort of become aware that, you know, all around me people are struggling to sleep increasingly. A lot of this is to do with our 24/7 always on kind of a lifestyle. So really, I wanted to make a piece which would just allow us to, you know, step off the hamster wheel for a moment and, have a piece which could function really like a place to rest.
Richter enlisted the help of a friend, an American neuroscientist named David Eagleman.
I just called him up and sort of picked his brain a little bit about sort of relationships between sound and the sleeping mind. Slow wave sleep, which is a bit of the sleep cycle, which is where short-term memory is turned into sort of hard information. It's the origin of that phrase, you know, I need to sleep on that. And that process, it turns out, can be sort of sustained and propagated by repetitive low-frequency sounds. I took away all the high-frequency sounds. And I did that because that mirrors the spectrum that the baby hears inside the mother's body. So I used that spectrum as a way to kind of evoke a sort of a first memory kind of a sense and kind of universality. And then after about 7 hours, the spectrum starts to open up and it does a kind of acoustic sunrise. Musical standpoints, a set of variations, you know. And that gives a feeling of sort of recognition and, in a way, a kind of a safety. It's like, you know, when you drive a route for the first time, it's kind of stressful, but when you drive it again, you just feel very calm. And I wanted that sort of trip through the night to be a sort of a calm trip.
Richter wrote all 8 hours of this piece, which is naturally called Sleep, on paper, then recorded it and released it in 2015. Then he had an even crazier idea: perform the whole thing live, overnight, in a giant sleepover concert where audience members are on beds. He did it in London, and it was so successful that he's done it again in Berlin, New York, and at South by Southwest.
It's got that sort of Mount Everest quality, you know? It's just kind of there, so you feel like you have to climb it. But also, fundamentally for me, I mean, music is a real-time conversation between performers and the audience, and I just sort of felt like I wanted to try that.
Richter performs with the same group from the recording, five members from the American Contemporary Music Ensemble and soprano Grace Davidson.
It's very physically demanding. You know, we have to get sort of jet-lagged the right amount so that when we go on the stage at the beginning of the show, it's kind of morning for us. It's a hard show to play. I mean, when I sit down, the beginning of the evening is, you know, 250 pages of piano music on the stand. And that's just a lot of notes to play.
This weekend, Richter is bringing Sleep to Los Angeles. And he's trying something new, performing it outdoors in downtown's Grand Park.
Well, outdoors, you've got the sky, you know, and the sky is endlessly interesting, isn't it? You've got all the different colors and textures, and if it's clear, you've got some stars.
There are 569 assigned cots for performances on both Friday and Saturday night. So what, logistically, does an overnight minimalism concert in a downtown park entail? I went to Grand Park to meet Howard Sherman, chief operating officer at the Music Center, with a list of questions.
My first question for you is, why? Why this crazy, ambitious, unorthodox, bizarre experience?
The core of our mission is enhancing the cultural life of every member of the County of Los Angeles. So we try to do that by doing all kinds of different programming, by using the spaces we operate in all kinds of different and creative ways. And the idea of expanding on an audience that wouldn't think of the Music Center as presenting this sort of event is right up our alley.
I show up for the event. What happens?
The event starts at 10:30. The box office opens at 9. And once you're in and through security, you go to your assigned cot, you set up, and you lay down and listen to 8 hours of incredible music.
Toilets. What if people need to use a restroom?
We will be bringing in high-end porta-potties, so there will be facilities here that will be available all night.
What about just security in the park overnight?
No different than it is any other night. We have 24-hour security here. The park is technically closed overnight, so we'll be securing the park as we would any other night, just in this moment in time, we'll actually have several hundred people listening to music in part of the park.
So what's the right way to experience Sleep? Max Richter says there isn't one.
Some people literally turn up, go to sleep, and we see them, you know, at the end. Other people, they'll be sitting on their beds, sort of listening intently as though it were an ordinary show. And a lot of people wander around, or they do a bit of dozing, or, you know, they come to the front and listen, and they go back to their cots. Or it does have a bit of a sort of campfire quality in some way, because sleep is normally something kind of intimate and private. And if you're sort of in a field with 500 strangers sleeping, there's something quite vulnerable about that. It seems to foster a sort of a community spirit, which is really lovely, actually.
For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
Unfortunately, both nights of Max Richter's overnight concert at Grand Park are sold out, but one can always dream. That's it for today. Remember to keep up with us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Join us back here tomorrow.